Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello everyone, and welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show where we demonstrate that everything, simply everything you could possibly think of, has its own history, like pigs, parsley, or mistakes.
I think you're quite wrong there, Sam. I think you've made a mistake there. There can't be a history of mistakes. That sounds like one of our homeschooling episodes. Or hitting, knitting, and sitting, fitting, flitting, and outwitting. I'd love to do the idea of outwitting the Scarlet Pimpernel or something like that. That'd be brilliant. However, we digress as ever, but we are in festive mood. We will be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, who knew that the history of obscenity is in fact all about Christmas via rude ice sculptures, snowball fights between soldiers, name-calling in the 17th century in Bradnich, or puritanical attitudes in 19th century America, or that the history of smoke is all about statecraft and diplomacy. It's about ritualised smoking of the peace pipe, and it's all to do with smuggling and public execution. In fact, I've been going through our back catalogue, Sam, and would you believe we have done now over 200 episodes of Histories of the Unexpected, and I think in the whiz and whir of our working, I was lost for words there, so I rarely am, but it just sort of lost with the idea that we've done 200 episodes. I think we missed that milestone. I don't think we've celebrated it properly. I think we should do that now.
Let's Hurrah! Do that now. Well done us. Hooray!
Hurrah! Woo!
Well done us. You're probably wondering who this man is talking to me. Let me just say that if history was a wild herd of reindeer frolicking on the tundra of Svalbard, this man would be the ancient wise herder, cloaked in reindeer skin, booted in reindeer boots, hair slicked with reindeer oil, a wild shaman of the great history herd itself. He is Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. It's James Daybell. Hello, James.
Hello, Sam. And, I'm full of Christmas cheer, actually. It's the last day of term. I have a three-hour class to teach. I have some paperwork to do, and then I am done, which is brilliant. But the man sitting opposite me, because we are social distancing in these grim days of lockdown, well, let's just say, if he were an elf who was the maestro of Reindeer Keeper, he'd only be Patch himself, played by Dudley Moore in that brilliant movie, Santa Claus the Movie, that creative and inventive elf, that brilliant elf who could turn his hand to anything, including amazing maritime history. It is your favourite famous historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis.
Thank you very much. Hello, everyone. We are doing reindeer. It's one I've wanted to do for ages, and we're carrying on our Christmassy themes. I hope you're enjoying them all. This is going to be a main full episode as opposed to one of our little micro history fun things. So we're going to try and take down for you the extraordinary history of reindeer. Daybell, where would you like to begin?
Oh, well, Sam, you know me. I'm an old softie and I'm full of Christmas cheer. So I'm going to start with the history of Santa Claus reindeer. I'm afraid, though, a spoiler alert, there is also in this some myth-busting about Father Christmas's reindeer, just in case there are some children listening. So The idea behind Santa Claus reindeer, as we all know, is a sort of it's a very sort of traditional festive legend. The idea is that he travels around the world delivering presents to boys and girls who've been naughty, who've been nice, not naughty. And his sleigh is pulled through the sky by his reindeer. And we know the commonly cited names of those reindeer are Dasher and Dancer, Prancer and Vixen, Comet and Cupid, Donner and Blitzen, and of course Rudolph comes slightly later, but he's not one of the first reindeer. He's an invention in the 1930s, and I'm going to talk about that a little later on. Now, of course, these names are literary fictions, as of course you know, and one of the most well-known ones, or probably lesser-known ones, is a book that came out in 1821, which included a poem titled "Old Santa Claus with Much Delight," and this precedes the "'Twas the Night Before Christmas," the Clement Seymour poem that we've talked about in the past. It is the first publication, and also the first publication to illustrate Father Christmas's reindeer and sleigh, and it describes him arriving on Christmas Eve. And it's a lovely little manuscript that still survives. If you Google it, you can see it. There's a beautiful illustration of Father Christmas on a green sleigh with little baskets of toys and the message "rewards" on the back of the sleigh, and only one reindeer, a reindeer who has antlers. Father Christmas looks rather weird. He looks like a sort of red Cossack here. He's got a little red jacket with little brown buttons and a brown beard and brown sort of what looks like a sort of trapper's beaver hat on. He looks very dashing here. But I just want to read you a little extract from this poem, just to give you a sort of sense of it. It's thought that it might have been by Clement Seymour, but we don't really know because it's entirely anonymous and it predates the more famous poem, which is a couple of years later. "Old Santa Claus, with much delight, his reindeer drives this frosty night o'er chimney tops and tracks of snow to bring his yearly gifts to yo." That doesn't quite work there, that rhyme. I should critique that. "The steady friend of virtuous youth, the friend of duty and of truth, each Christmas Eve he joys to come where love and peace have made their home. Through many houses he has seen, and various beds and stockings seen, some white as snow and neatly mended, others that seemed for pigs intended. Where'er I found good girls or boys that hated quarrels, strife and noise, I left an apple or a tart or wooden gun or painted cart. To some I gave a pretty doll, to some a peg top or a ball. No crackers, cannons, squibs or rockets to blow their eyes up or their pockets. No drums to stun their mother's ear, nor swords to make their sisters fear, but pretty books to store their mind with knowledge of each various kind. But where I found the children naughty, in manners rude, in temper haughty, thankless to parents, liars, swearers, boxers or cheats, or base tale bearers, I left a long black birchen rod, such as the dread command of God directs a parent's hand to use when virtue's path his sons refuse." He's a very puritanical Father Christmas here, isn't it? Not leaving any fun toys at all, and leaving a rod for a parent to beat a wayward and naughty child. So this is one of the first literary depictions that we have of Father Christmas with his reindeer, a beautiful pen illustration of it. But more famously, the names of Father Christmas's reindeer come from a very famous 1823 poem, "A Visit from St. Nicholas," which is commonly called "The Night Before Christmas" by Clement Seymour. And this poem, I think, is really well known. I read it every year to my children at Christmas. And this is where we get the name from of the reindeer. And I just want to read the little relevant segment of the poem here. when what to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer with a little old driver so lively and quick I knew in a moment it must be Saint Nick. More rapid than eagles his course as they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Dunder and Blitzen. To top of the porch, to top of the wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away all, as dry leaves that before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle mount to the sky. So up to the housetop the coursers they flew. So we not only get the sense of them being named, but also we see them landing on a chimney, landing on a roof, going down the chimney, and then flying through the sky. But these are not the only names that were given to the reindeer, because L. Frank Baum, he of Wizard of Oz fame, in his Life and Adventures of Santa Claus in 1902, includes a list of 10 reindeer. Slightly different. They're slightly different. They're Flossy and Glossy. And then there are others, Racer and Pacer, Fearless and Peerless, Ready and Steady, Feckless and Speckless.
Do you know what, James? Those are a list of your suggestions for histories of the unexpected.
No. They should be. We should do all of them as Christmas specials.
Let's do Fearless and Peerless.
Yes. However, one of my favourite recent Christmas books that has a reindeer in it is, have you ever read this? The Empty Stocking. One of the best Christmas books of the last 20 years, I'd say, by the brilliant Richard Curtis, and illustrated by a brilliant children's illustrator called Rebecca Cobb. I came across her illustrations years ago, and I met her a couple of times, one as a book signing and one at a book award, and I sort of was a very sort of fanboy about her. She's so talented. The illustrations of it are just brilliant, and they work so well with the words. But it's basically, The Empty Stocking is a story about two children who are twins. One has been naughty, one has been nice, and Father Christmas arrives and leaves an empty stocking on one of the beds, and the story goes on from there. I won't spoil it, but there is this wonderful description of Father Christmas's reindeer. He landed in the garden, placed the hungry reindeer near a tasty hedge, and then in brackets, by the way, look out for that next year if you've got a garden. You'll normally find that a bit of it has been mightily munched on Christmas morning. So it's sort of Santa Claus's reindeer brought straight up to date.
Wonderful.
So there we are, Sam, the history of Father Christmas's reindeer.
That's right. So one way of looking at this this wonderful subject... It's amazing to think about how all these wonderful creative people throughout time just sitting down and doing it. And, it's a completely valid way of studying history. You can literally, you could write a PhD on the way that the Christmas story, and particularly his reindeer, has passed down to us in present day, if you were interested in that. James would supervise it.
I would supervise it.
Other ways of looking at reindeer I was... given the dangerous book for boys as a kind of ironic joke, being an adult, many years ago when it came out and it was super famous by Con and Hal Ingledon. It's a great thing. And it's based on a established tradition of sort of adventurous literature for boys going back to the mid-19th century. And I've come across one of them. And I had a quick flick through it to see how it dealt with the natural world. And it's got a fantastic section on reindeer. This is the Wild Sports of the World book, a boy's book of natural history and adventure by James Greenwood, and it was published in 1862. Now, if you ever have a chance to look at one of these, I do recommend you do. Make sure you look at the introductions, because they're absolutely brilliant. They tell you so much about people's perception of... if they're written in England, of the UK at the time. This is the introduction to this book, The Wild Sports of the World. The history of a nation like ours, the secret of its vast successes, is not to be written in a word or sought in any one or any dozen qualities, But if we had to choose amongst the philosophers who pretend to have traced the national life to its source, there are not many of us who would not declare for those who find the secret in adventure. It is simply an historical fact that England was born of adventure. It was this spirit in the great old Scandinavians, from whom we have the honour to descend, which scattered amongst the oaks of Britain, a people that took as kindly to its soil as they, and which in 1,000 years had lost none of the fibre that pulled the old beaked galleys over the terrible North Sea. So there we are, a fantastic starting point for this sports book. And I think it's basically accepting and appreciating that all English people are related to Vikings. I think that's the whole purpose of that. And the author is obviously quite focused on our northern links and spends a really large amount of his time writing about reindeer. There's all sorts of wonderful reindeer-related information, not least why are reindeer important to native inhabitants of the chilly north of Lapland and northern Finland, Spitsbergen, in the Svalbard archipelago off the north coast of Norway. So again, as perceived in 1862. Habitat of the reindeer. What the horse is to us is the reindeer to the swarthy-faced, stunted inhabitant of Lapland or Spitsbergen. The reindeer is the Lapp's cow and sheep and ox and ass rolled into one. It furnishes him with roofing for his house, not her. It furnishes him with roofing for his house, with flooring for ditto, with a bed to lie on, with clothes and shoes, with cordage and strings to his bow, with meat dried and fresh, with milk liquid, or in preserved and frozen lumps, and with blood puddings. By the reindeer, the Laplander lives and moves and has his being. Reindeer is with him, but another term for wealth, and as exactly represents it as does gold in the ordinary commercial sense. The man Lapp and the woman Lapp alike adopt the skin of this precious member of the deer family as clothing material, and both wear precisely the same shaped garments. A pair of breeches is cut from the skin of a fawn, sewn with fine gut strings with a reindeer bone needle. A pair of deer hide stockings are drawn over the feet and secured above the knee by deer thong garters, while the hairy coat stripped from the back of the deer and transferred to that of the Lapp is converted into a pelisse by a very simple process. The fags and hanging pieces are just trimmed off, a big hole cut in the centre for the head and two smaller ones for the arms, and the garment is complete and together with the breeches and stockings thoroughly equips the lady or gentleman Lapp. Then he continues, he carries on with this wonderful idea of reindeers being not only another term for wealth, but actually exactly represents it like gold does to the British at the time. As may be imagined, the constant demand by the Lapp's family for reindeer is not met by the possession of a mere half dozen animals. 20, 40, 50 is held to be an insignificant number. Indeed, when a man possesses the latter number, he invariably lends them and himself to a large proprietor, until by his earnings and the natural course of events, the herd amounts to 100. Then he has the right to the title of a free reindeer Lapp, and becomes an independent member of society. By industry and clever bartering, some Lapps will amass 1,000 head of deer, some indeed nearly 2,000. But these are the Barings and Rothschilds of Lapland society and are treated as such. So there we are. I love that idea, James, of the reindeer not just being an animal that can carry you somewhere, but as currency, and also the reindeer as a status symbol. Very interesting and important indeed. Anyway, all of this, of course, is wrapped up in a story about commercial publishing. So, yes, these are telling us about Lapps or what people understood about Lapps in the 1860s, but also you need to think about them as being acknowledged and supported as successful stories that would appeal to young boys in the UK in the third quarter of the 19th century. So there are two layers of history here, and one of them's actually all to do with publishing.
Oh, Sam, what a seamless link into my own expose on commercial publishing, because we left the very exciting story of Father Christmas's reindeer back in the 19th century. However, you'll notice that there were only nine reindeer, I think, and no Rudolph. And so what I want to talk about now is the invention of the very famous Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is a song that we all know. We all know from our childhood nowadays, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. It's been a book, it's been a film, it's been a song. But it started as a marketing experiment. So I want to take you back to the time of the Great Depression. And a retailer in Chicago called Montgomery Ward was basically wondering what to do for their Christmas season, what to do in their department stores. And they thought that it would be a really good idea if for all the American children at the time, they had a Christmas story that could go out in all of their stores. So what they do, they go to their ad man. And they say, you know, guy, can you come up with a story for us? And this is a guy who is Robert Louis May. And this is somebody who's in his sort of 30s at this point. I think he had aspirations to be a sort of great writer, to write the great American novel. And he finds himself basically writing copy for marketing for this retailer. But what he does is he goes off and spends a few weeks thinking about this, and he comes up with the idea of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And we all know that Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer has no friends and then suddenly comes back and saves the day for Father Christmas. And in some ways, what he's doing here is he is encapsulating the American dream for children. I mean, effectively, that anyone from anywhere can, if they, you know, if they're possessed with sort of special qualities or not, is able to make a real success. So this unfortunate little reindeer with an odd red-coloured nose, you know, comes and saves the day for Father Christmas. And this is something that, you know, has real sort of meaning for American children. There's a lot of cultural significance about it. But I want to say a little bit about the idea of the red nose. Where does the red nose come from? And apparently, when May was sort of wondering, you know, about the story and how to sort of depict little Rudolph, he was apparently, you know, looking out of his office one day in Chicago in the downtown area, and it was really foggy. And apparently it hit him like a flash of lightning. I know. And he's quoted saying, "Suddenly I had it. A nose, a bright red nose that would shine through fog like a spotlight." And there you have it, the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Now, apparently he took this to his boss, and his boss read the story and he said, "Can't you come up with anything better? You know, how disappointing." Nonetheless, May goes off. He's really sort of keen on the story. He goes off to a colleague in the art department, and the guy puts together a series of sketches and drawings that would illustrate his book. And together they manage to convince the boss that they should put this forward, that they should publish it. And get this, they then print 2 million copies of it, and they send it out in branches all over the country.
And that's a big gamble right there.
It's a big gamble, but it is a but it is a huge hit. It's a huge hit. And they've got there's a map in the archives of the distribution of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and it goes through each and every one of the 50 states in the US, and it is a huge success. The problem is, as you can imagine, May doesn't get any of the royalties out of this. He's basically been asked to write it. These millions of books are sold. The profit goes to the company. And, you know, there's also a quite a sad side to this, because he's in his 30s. His wife is ill. She suffers from cancer. He's down on his luck. He's quite, you know, hard up. And then the CEO of the company, a guy called Sewell Avery, in the period after World War II, decides that he will give the rights of Rudolph to May. And, you know, we don't quite know why. I mean, there's some sort of romantic associations that, you know, the good spirited, you know, CEO, you know, full of sort of Christmas cheer, bequeathed it to him. But, one doesn't necessarily buy that. However, With these rites, he takes it along to his brother-in-law, who is a songwriter. So he and his brother-in-law team up, and he persuades his brother-in-law to write the song Rudolph, the well-known song that we know today. And then the song is bought by the singing cowboy Gene Autry. And do you know how
many? I want to be a singing cowboy.
Do you know how many songs, how many copies were sold? 25 million.
Oh, and, you know, when was what time is this? This is
post World War II. So we're looking at the 1940s, 1950s. And it then gets made into an animation film. And so I suppose Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is itself a story that is part of the American dream. You know, this hard luck copywriter stuck in a dead end job writing copy for advertising magazines, you know, suddenly discovers this great idea for Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. He gets given the rights. He then turns it into a song with his brother-in-law. It gets picked up by a, you know, famous country and western singer and, you know, multi-million selling, and he's absolutely fit. But we couldn't end without a rendition of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, could we? You know Dasher and Dancer and Prancer and Vixen, Comet and Cupid and Donner and Blitzen, but do you recall the most famous reindeer of all? Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer had a very shiny nose, and if you ever saw it, you would even say it glows. All of the other reindeer used to laugh and call him names. They never let poor Rudolph join in any reindeer games. Then one foggy Christmas Eve, Santa came to say, Rudolph, with your nose so bright, won't you guide my sleigh tonight? Then how the reindeer loved him, and they shouted out with glee, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you'll go down in history. There we are. Did you like that?
That was brilliant.
It was all right, wasn't it? I'm afraid, though, Sam, I have a spoiler for you now about this. So, children, block your ears now. This is only for adults, because I've been doing a little bit of detective work and I have discovered the science of Santa's reindeer, courtesy of the Franklin Institute. Now, I've got a series of questions to see if we prove that Father Christmas's reindeer exists. Do reindeer exist? That's your basic question. Yes, of course they do. They're also known as caribou. They're a member of the deer family, and they live in herds of a few hundred. So there are apparently about the largest herd numbers between 400,000 and a million. Now, second question, do they live at the North Pole? This is important for detecting whether Father Christmas actually had reindeer. No. The North Pole is in the middle of the usually covered Arctic Ocean, which makes it very hard for terrestrial animals to reach. So there, we're disproving it on that. Do they have red noses? This one will interest you, Sam Willis. Yes, some really do. Did you know that? Some really do. And maybe May was actually drawing on that evidence rather than the fog outside. He actually knew that they... that their noses have a red tingle because, and I quote, of the presence of a highly dense and rich nasal microcirculation. In other words, they've got all sorts of blood vessels in the nose. Importantly, though, we need to consider whether they can fly. No, reindeer are mammals.
Thank you for that.
The only mammals that fly are bats.
Okay. Oh, that's really interesting. I didn't know that.
If they could fly, so here's a sort of counterfactual question. If they could fly, could they pull a sleigh? Possibly, yes. But pulling Santa's sleigh is very, very different. If you consider all the trillion or so presents and toys that would be there, probably not. It would be far too busy. So I'd have like a million tons. Also, what about Santa's famous reindeer crew? And here's the kicker, Sam, because we know this all male team of nine reindeer: Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, Vixen, Comet, Cupid, Donner, Blitzen, plus Rudolph. Okay, they're all male. However, they all are shown with antlers. Now, here's the thing. Did you know that reindeer are the only deer where both males and females grow antlers, but adult males shed their antlers around Christmas time. And this is the thing. Santa's team are basically all girls.
Ah.
Or they don't exist.
Well, we could, of course, consider that.
However, but what we haven't taken into account for is magic feed for reindeer, which, of course, would make them fly.
Yes.
So
I'll bear that in mind.
Anyway, I put in that deeply historical Mythbuster there.
No, there was a bit of history in there. There was a bit of history about the guy who wrote it, whether he knew where there was going to be red noses or not, which I can tell us about his understanding of the natural world back in the 1950s or whenever it was written. Were any of them ever trapped and murdered, do you reckon?
No, but I imagine that's where you're going next.
Do you know what? I was enjoying my lapse in the 1860s, and the obvious point to raise is, if they were so precious to the Lapps and the Eskimo, how did they protect them? Well, what they actually did was their main predator was wolves, and this is a little description of how Eskimo traps wolves to protect their reindeer.
Ooh.
The Eskimo, whose sledge dogs and reindeer are in hourly peril, construct an ingenious trap for their most terrible enemy. It is indeed fashioned on exactly the same principle as the familiar square wooden mouse trap. Only that the sides and roof are made of slabs of ice, and the front, instead of being wire, is likewise of ice and slides up and down in grooves. The sliding front is raised and secured by a string which passes through the back of the trap and is attached to a hook within the icy walls on which the bait is hung. At the very first nibble, the transparent door is released and slides down with a crash, and the Eskimo, leisurely knocking a hole in the wall of the trap just large enough to insert his spear, thrusts at the helpless wolf till it dies. Ooh, pretty nasty there. Made me ask this other more important question, James, is how do you trap a reindeer? And there are all sorts of reindeer hunting. So we've been talking about reindeer herding. Reindeer hunting is absolutely fascinating. There's a really interesting archaeology to it. So if you think about the Scandinavian Peninsula, you need to realise that the high mountains gradually became deglaciated about 10,000 years ago. And almost immediately, new land is created, new land is revealed from what was the ice cap before. And it's not long before they're inhabited by populations of reindeer, of the type that exist on tundra. And they are forced often to leave their original traditional coastal lowland feeding grounds as a result of forest formation and other landscape changes. So what you've got is reindeer moving around in enormous herds. So how do you hunt them? How do you actually catch these things? So there are two main strategies, and it's quite common for any other large game hunting. Firstly, with hunting with bow and arrow, usually from a short range, usually within 25 to 30 metres, or by collective drives where you push a herd of reindeer and you sort of corral them into a fenced area where they're trapped and then they can be killed. But there's one other solution, and it's by using something called a pitfall. And pitfalls are you dig a hole in the ground, essentially, along the migration routes of the reindeer. And that it's called a passive way of hunting. It means that the reindeer essentially traps itself. So they're traps sunk into the ground. They're artificially dug cavities. They're often stone-lined. Occasionally they have impaling stakes. Although, interestingly, some archaeological excavation of some recently has not discovered any such impaling stakes. What they actually want to do is to preserve the reindeer in as good a condition as possible before they can kill it in a more controlled way. There are thousands of these pitfalls throughout the Scandinavian Peninsula, and they've been recognised and understood as prehistoric monuments since the 1840s. But interestingly, very few indeed have actually been excavated. So this is a bit of a call to all of you Scandinavian archaeologists out there. Please get out there and start excavating your reindeer pitfalls, because I reckon there'll be all sorts of wonderful stuff in and around them. One of the great things about archaeology is when you dig a hole, then you've got to chuck all the mud that you've dug out, and it's in those soil piles that you find a lot of evidence that help you to date the hole and also to have little artifacts in there. So, you know, what do you do with this understanding? So, yes, you'd be able to might find evidence of the people doing the actual digging. But if you can actually map and you can use GPS to plot where these pitfalls are, then you can recreate the movements of reindeer at a certain period of time. It's a really, really clever way of understanding how the landscape was used, how the landscape changed, and actually the movements of huge herds of reindeer across immense areas of land. So there you go. These reindeer pitfalls all throughout Scandinavia are just waiting to be excavated, waiting to be discovered, and have some super, super clever history and archaeology written about them. Been known, as I said, since the 1840s, but no one's actually done anything about them. So
maybe your next project, Sam.
Yeah. Yeah,
reindeer
pits, I think so. Let's leave it there for now. It's been a wonderful...
However, before we do, I have some interesting reindeer facts for you to show you that they are sort of quite almost magical creatures. Did you know that reindeer have colour-changing eyes? So they have a different sort of colour eye in the summer when their eyes are gold, and when winter comes around they turn blue, because it means that they're able to see much better in reflected light. They're also the only animals able to see ultraviolet light. They also float. They're able to float, which is extraordinary. And they have clicky knees. Did you know that? When they walk around, their knees make an audible click, presumably so that other animals can hear them in the snow. This is all courtesy, these brilliant facts, of the Franklin Institute. So thank you guys for that, for enlivening enlivening my life, actually. I need to know about reindear. I think that's probably enough for this little part. I've got tons more on reindeer.
Good, good. We're looking forward to it. We're going to come back with a part two. I'm going to talk about some reindeer hunting sites in Svalbard, and I'm going to talk about one of the best Arctic rescue stories ever in the whole history of history. And it involves reindeer. That's coming your way soon. Hope you're enjoying that. Do please follow us on Twitter. I'm at Dr. Sam Willis. And if you like maritime and naval history, which I hope you all do, please check out my new podcast, the Mariner's Mirror Podcast.
Love a bit of maritime history myself. But you can also follow me on Twitter on at James Daybell. You can follow the pod on at Unexpected Pod. We are also on Instagram and Facebook, so check us out there. Also, have a look at our brilliant website, historiesoftheunexpected.com, where you can see everything that we are up to. And as we are continuing this massive plug for all that we do, also think of us on Patreon. We have a Patreon page which helps support the podcast, and we're doing so many episodes at the moment, and the production costs for that all need to be paid for. So you know, help us out if you can, guys.
Yeah, any teachers out there, do please check out the homeschooling episode. They're fun, and we're going to be doing some more of them next year. That's it for now, guys. See you soon. Bye.
Happy Christmas, guys.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.